Welcome back to another episode of the Behind the Wall podcast, sponsored by Campus Steaks. It's a Philly thing. Joined by Bradley Spider Caldwell today. Thank you so much for joining us.
Really a pleasure to be here, Landon.
It is an honor. Yeah. And for anybody that doesn't know, Spider here is an absolute legend in the Penn State community. You know, equipment manager from early 80s to 2014?
Yeah.
Yep, and he is beloved by everybody around, the players, the coaches. So it's an honor to sit down with him. Yeah.
Appreciate it. This is fun.
Absolutely.
It'll be a lot of fun. So.
No doubt. Well, first thing I want to ask.
Yeah.
You got to go. You got something?
No, I'm good.
Okay.
No, I'm good.
First thing I want to ask is, how'd you get started in equipment?
Really high school. When I was in school, I was very shy and kind of, you know, a little bit backward and whatnot. I just got done with eighth grade and I'm going into ninth grade. And my science teacher from eighth grade called me at home and said, hey, he was the junior high football coach, and said, hey, I'm looking for a kid I think would be a good worker, and I'd like to want to know if you're interested in being a manager for the high school team. So I'm like, I don't know, and should I do that? Well, my good friend was going to be playing on the team, so he talked me into it. So, yeah, okay, I'll do it. So I went, and I was a junior high manager for like 3-4 days, and the varsity coach saw me, and he kind of knows my family, and they had a kid the year before that had done a real nice job, and he was just a senior, and he did it 1 year. And they said, oh, we get somebody younger, and we can kind of train him, and he can be our manager for, 4 years. So I didn't want to leave my junior high coach, because he just promised me, or I just promised him that I'd do that. And so he said, well, so my junior high coach said, hey, it's varsity, you got to go to varsity. And and said, you go do it. So I think you'll do a nice job for him. So I was only with him 3 or 4 days. So I went and did varsity football, and loved it. And then I ended up doing also wrestling and baseball. So I did three sports. I did it for 4 years, and it was fun. Like I said, by the end of my senior year, I had the keys to the high school and could come and go whenever, and was whatnot. So, and that's what really got me into it. Mm. Now, I'll tell you kind of a cool story, and it's kind of unique that I ended up my eighth grade science teacher really got me into science and astronomy. And this is back when the space program had just, we landed on the moon, 10 years before that. And so, I was really into that. And I always aspired to be an astronaut. But I knew physically couldn't be an astronaut just with my birth defect and my scoliosis. So I always wanted to work for Mission Control in Houston. I wanted to be that guy that was sitting there going, Roger, Houston, the Eagle has landed, Roger. So,
right. Anyway. Behind the scenes.
So, so my senior year, the awards banquet at high school, and all my coaches, they went and they got an engraved watch, and it said, outstanding contribution to athletic teams of my high school, and they had the years on it, and gave it to me in front of the whole student body, and so afterwards, my eighth grade science teacher came up to me, and his wife was pregnant at the time with their first child. And he points to her belly. And I'm not saying this to toot my own horn or whatever, but he points to her belly and says, I hope this kid grows up to be half of what you are. Mm. And nicest compliment anybody's ever made to me. And I'm crying. He's crying, And why I say that is that kid today works for Mission Control in Houston.
Really?
That's what he does. His job.
That's a full circle moment right there.
Isn't that unbelievable? So I just always have to. I just love telling that story and how it just how that fate happened. So, but anyway, I went to Dubois Branch campus my first year, and I was inspired to still be an aerospace engineer. Okay, and that's what my major was. Mm. Well, I'm there. Penn State is playing for the 82 National Championship.
Right.
And I had applied to be a student manager, and I got the job. I actually got called and said, he'd love to have you, but we can't do anything to get you to main campus. So I changed majors to get to main campus. Back then, it was a little trick of the trade you could do. So
anything you had to do to get in.
So I'm like, hey, I got to do this opportunity. So I instantly transferred in the after the spring of 82, 83, and came to main campus, and then I joined the team in the fall of 83, Okay. And I was a student manager for four seasons. My senior year, they were building Haluba Hall. Mm. Okay. And the interesting part was when I transferred to main campus, I changed majors. Well, I was going to change back into aerospace engineering, but I knew the time commitment was so huge. After preseason, I'm like, oh boy, I'm not going to be able to handle the workload with aerospace engineering.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. I know the workload that especially our student managers have to take on, and that aerospace engineering sounds like
I just knew right away, and I knew I really enjoyed, the football equipment end of it. Mm. So I had a recreation and park management introduction class at the time, and wasn't thinking of that route, but what was kind of cool about it, we had no sports management program at the time. So, but I wanted to, you don't go to school to be equipment manager. There's no degree for that, technically. So I was able to go through rec parks and commercial recreation, and I could gear my major towards my emphasis of what I wanted to be a sports manager. So I actually took an accounting class and a management class, labor studies class, athletic coaching class at the time, so I was able to build my major and kind of structure it through commercial recreation. So, and then I did my internship, my practicum, my senior year with the football team as a manager.
Oh, okay, that's awesome.
So it really worked out well. And then I, was real fortunate. And like I said, I was kind of at the right, also the timing was great. I was at the right place at the right time. When I said that my senior year, they were building Haluba Hall at the time. And so they wanted more manpower. We had no assistant equipment manager at the time. And so our director of football operations went to Coach Paterno and said, hey, Spider's interested in doing this as a career. What's he interested? Why does he want to do that? This is Joey. Like, why does he want to do that for? Well, so I'm like, no, he really wants to do this, Coach. He really enjoys it. So I had a couple internships lined up. I had with the Seattle Seahawks and the Denver Broncos. I was going to maybe go do an internship with them. Mm. But Joe okayed it and said, and I was still a senior. That's my last semester in December. I graduated in December.
Right. So were you the head man?
I was the head equipment manager in 86. Okay. And when we won the second national championship.
Hell of a year to get your start, huh?
It was fantastic. And I literally, after we won the national championship, I started as the assistant equipment manager. Mm. And they also, I come in like at noon. And I'd work in the equipment room from noon till after winter workouts or spring practice. Then I would go to Haluba, and I'd sit in Haluba till like 10 o'clock at night. So I worked kind of like a second shift because it was brand new. We didn't know how we wanted to handle it.
Right.
So then I'd close Haluba up when other teams were done using it in the evening. And then after spring, when teams started going outside, then I was able to – we were able to just we weren't using it as heavy in the spring, late spring. So then I just worked football full go through the fall or summer. And then that fall, we decided just higher wage payroll to sit up there in the evenings. Mm. So I stayed in the equipment room the full time. And then just eventually took over as the head equipment manager a few years later. And it's been history.
Very cool story. I do want to ask you, though, you were talking about early on there was no assistant equipment manager. Yeah. From the early 80s to when you retired in 2014, what was the evolution that you saw of, the type of equipment you guys had, the technology, the amount of people on the staff? How was that transition from the 80s to, 2010s?
Yeah, it was the managers were really an integral part, a lot of how we ran things in the day. Because, we only had, counting the coaches, we had and staff assistants and whatnot, we had 29 people.
Wow.
That's it. And I think, the staff now is around almost 80.
Oh, 80 and a ton of interns and assistants, absolutely.
Right, and that's just right. That's the full-time.
It's
that always amazes me from the perspective of, looking at it now. Like, it's just amazing. And I know it's just what it is. I mean, it's just how, it's the model now, and it's the, Alabama model, I guess, as they kind of started this trend. And it's to keep up with the Joneses. You need the people.
It is.
But yeah, we really had a skeleton crew, and manager wise, I was always surprised. Not when I got into the role as the assistant equipment manager, and then eventually took over full time. I was always shocked that the responsibility that I ended up having as a junior and senior manager, when I was still in school. Because the responsibility that the head equipment manager gave me was like, wow, now I look back, I'd be nervous to have my guy do it. You know, I was packing trunks and this responsibility of, you know, making sure we had everything. And but I appreciate it. I think it was a great learning experience for me. I was able to, learn a lot myself and just, and be prepared for taking over eventually, you know? So, but yeah, and as far as equipment, that's the revolution. The really evolution, besides the size of staffs and stuff like that, is just seeing how equipment became so much more, lighter, water resistant, water repellent.
Yeah, the helmets now, when we go in to get fitted for our helmets, we put on this weird skull cap. Yeah. And they basically take pictures.
Yeah, and like they're doing a 3D image like of your head skull. Yeah,
exactly. Shape. You get your head scanned. Like I remember back in the day, like you'd show up to Little League and they'd put a XL on you. They say, all right, it fits. They smack your head. They say, all right, it looks good. And then that's it.
I almost brought with me today, and I said, if we ever do a road show and you come to my office someday, I'll show you some of the
memorabilia.
And I have I got a nice collection of the helmets. That was the evolution of them from 1962, and I have one of every decade clear through to the current. Okay, and it's in the Letterman's Lounge, and I just look back at that one. I was going to bring it today, but I said I didn't. But the one from 62, Rydell called it a suspension helmet, and it literally has ropes in it. That's what it was a lineman's helmet, and the face mask was just like it looked like a kicker single bar. Wasn't single bar; it was double, but it was only about 2 inches wide, okay, and it had a U-bar on it. And the U-bar was gone; it had rusted off. But it's just funny looking at that. It was an offensive lineman. In fact, he played for the Raiders for years. I guess David Rao was his name, 1962. But and has a number on the side, number 76. You know, so you'll get a kick out of it. It wouldn't even fit your bicep.
Not at all.
Tiny, you know. So
the equipment has definitely evolved to keep the guys a little bit safer.
And what was fun for me is I was really being part of that evolution because, we were, I don't know, a lot of people, I don't know if you guys even know this, but we were one of the original four Nike schools. Okay. Nike started making, track shoes in the mid 70s. There was four teams back in 82, 83 that, four college teams that went with Nike, first ones ever, and this is when they started making football shoes. It was in 82, 83. So we field tested a lot of their stuff for them ahead of time. We would get equipment, and especially in the spring, from them. We'd test it and send it back, and they would, you could analyze, this and that and everything. So we were one of the original schools with them, and that's why Coach Paterno really developed a personal relationship with Phil Knight, the owner and CEO of Nike. And so through the years, they loved using us because we were a northern school on grass with a white, plain white uniform. So they could field test material. See, they didn't start making apparel and uniforms till 1993. So 10 years after they started making shoes. So we just had Nike shoes from 83 to 93, and then we started getting the apparel. And the first couple of years, their jerseys sucked. Okay, they were, we had, and their pants sucked, and it was just, and so we, but, we were really loyal to them. Mm-hmm. Joe was very loyal to Phil Knight, and we just kept working and working with them. But their research team was tops, and they listened. And they would fly here from Oregon, and they would be, like, watching everything, they'd be checking stuff, and it was just fun to watch that, the pants that you wear today. I mean, that material they used, the dry fit material was all, we saw it first. The gloves, the ball. Mm-hmm. We're the first one to use the ball. Okay, the football, football.
Really?
Yeah. Before we'd see gloves before they get the Dick's Sporting Goods, 1-2 years in advance, and we test them. So it was just fun to watch that and to see, the gloves they discovered, the material that's on the gloves now. That's they basically kind of because they used to just be leather. Well, they discovered it from the hazmat guys used it. And on their gloves and their material and their uniforms or whatever. So they kind of developed that into a glove, this hazmat material, because
Say they're extra sticky now. I know they almost got to stick them on there at this point. They make it real easy for those wide receivers. Look, Spider, I want to get into a little bit more behind the scenes of what it looks like to work as equipment manager. Can you take us through specifically an away game, kind of the process, let's just say from maybe Thursday on when you start to really start to pack up?
Yeah, and I think it's fairly similar. You know, I know, Ben and Herman and Austin, you know, they might have a little bit different routine now. But basically, you know, in our day and for years, but it almost started on Monday in the fact that you're cleaning up from the game. Okay, so that's a couple-day process, Monday, Tuesday, and then you're repacking the trunks. You know, the trunks that are on the sideline, the trunks that are in the locker room just get wrecked. So you're kind of reorganizing them, restacking them, restocking them. So then, you know, that's kind of that Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday thing. And then Thursday was our big day because after practice, that's when we would either pack the truck for away games or we actually packed the truck also for home games to take to move over to the Beaver Stadium because we just got into that routine, okay, because then we'd take everything over on Friday to the stadium or we would pack the truck Thursday night and it would leave Thursday night.
Right. So, did you guys, on Thursdays, we'd come in from the walkthrough and then we'd always have to put our shoes in the cubbies for you guys to bring over?
Yes. Well, that's exactly what we did. And we did the same – what we did – we had a tradition. I'm trying to get Ben and Austin back into this, and we had a tradition of painting the shoes. We actually polished them every Thursday, and that's something that Coach Paterno really pushed. We would off the practice field, we'd be like, hey, okay, guys, put your shoes in your cubbies. Get your shoes in your cubbies. So guys would put them in. We'd double check everybody had them in, and then we would actually polish them up, change cleats if we needed to, shoe strings as well. Not all of them, but just as needed. But we scrubbed all the shoes, and then that we'd put them back in, let them dry, and then we would actually, it's an away game, okay? So the guys would also, we'd tell them afterwards, you know, put your knee, hip, thigh, tail pads in, put in your, any of your braces, you know, your gloves you want and whatnot, but leave your helmets hang up and leave your shoes in your cubbies. So we paint the shoes, we polish them up, put them in the bags. Then we take the helmets, and we polish the helmets that night, too. Mm. We would take and clean them off. Magic eraser, that was the key. Mr. Clean, magic erasers.
Yeah, right.
And we clean the helmets. We change any face masks that were beat up and whatnot. Mm. And then we put them in. And the last thing we would put in was the shoes, so we knew we didn't forget them. And we'd zip the bag up and take it to the truck. You know, so, again, that was the routine. Then the truck would leave hopefully around 8, 9 o'clock.
Did you ever have to drive the truck to an away game?
No, I used to – I never had to physically drive it. We had a really good relationship with our company that's still doing it today, Hoy Transfer. Mm. They would take that we had, you know, they've been hauling our stuff since the 70s. And just a bunch of good guys, and they did it for years. So I was very fortunate in that regard. But I myself went to a couple bowl games on a truck. I just wanted to. I went across country to the Fiesta Bowl.
Driving the truck?
I was driving with them.
Right. How many days was that?
Four.
Wow.
We took
four days in the truck. Mm-hmm.
Slept in the truck. It was a blast. It was an absolute blast. And one funny story with that one. We get to, so the truck never shuts off. You know, it's on all the whole trip. Never it's idles all the time. So we're stopping at truck stops. We're sleeping. You know, eating and whatnot. So we actually got to Arizona on day three, and we went like a southern route, and then we come up to Phoenix. So we were just outside of Tucson, and the guy. Our truck driver is like, okay, we're gonna ride in with style, so we're gonna go to the truck wash here and wash the truck up, you know. So it was all dirty from the trip. So we pull into a big truck wash, and they get it all washed. And so you turn the engine off. It's the first we'd turned the engine off since we left State College. So after the truck gets all washed, he hits the dead. The truck was dead, wouldn't start. I'm like, oh no, you know. So the guy, when there was a bunch of Mexican workers there, you know, they were doing it. They go, truck no start? No, can't get to start. Put in neutral. Like, excuse me? Put in neutral. We're like, we're fully loaded from sealing the, you know, the ground.
Right,
it's
a lot of weight back
there. Like, so he puts it in neutral, and all of a sudden, we start moving. Like, what the heck? So we're looking back. Here's seven guys pushing this truck out of the car wash.
Right.
And we're like, you know, he basically, he jumps there. He popped the clutch and got it, and it took off, fired off. Like, I can't believe it.
Wow. So I guess we might have been gearless for the Fiesta Bowl if not for those guys.
Amen. Oh man, that's great. Yeah, you get all kinds of really interesting situations in a way.
Yeah, I'm sure. But you were talking about painting shoes.
Yeah.
And I wanted to ask you about painting Joe Paterno's shoes.
Yeah.
What was that ritual, and what did you have to do, and what did that look like?
See, it's funny. We had a thing called, it was a manager rite of passage. Mm. And so it was called, you do the shoes until you lose. So if you would actually, it would pass to a student manager, he'd polish Joe's shoes up, always put new strings in it every week. Brand new pair of rolled up socks sticking down in. Okay, got them all ready, and then, you know, put them in his bag. And then if you keep doing that until you lost, and then it would pass to a new manager. Okay. Mm. And so, funny story there. So we had one manager in 1985. We go 11-0. Okay. He does them all season. He started out fresh, new, and at the beginning of the season, he goes 11-0. Go to the Orange Bowl to play Oklahoma for the national title. We give Joe a new pair of shoes. We lose. All right, we're not making that same mistake twice. Next year, we bring the shoes back. We tell the same kid, you know what? You didn't technically lose. We give him a new shoe. So, you know, we didn't polish him that game. We give him the old shoes from the year before, 12-0. Won a national
1986? Title. That's an awesome story.
True story. So, you know, the whole shoe thing with Joe was... When he was a kid, he told me this story. The last couple of years with Coach Paterno, I really learned a lot about, more than ever, about the uniform and traditions that he had and that he brought with him from Brown University when he came with Rip Engel, who was a coach before him. Joe said, my uncle took, he said, I was a Brooklyn Dodgers fan, but we would go to the Yankees games. And we're sitting in the stands, and we're watching him, and he said, and my uncle would say, hey, now, Joey, watch the two teams when they come out of the dugout. And they were playing the St. Louis Cardinals at that day. He said, when St. Louis comes out, just look at their shoes in particular. So he's looking at the uniforms, he's looking down at his shoes, and St. Louis comes out, they have red shoes, white shoes, they're dirty, grass stained, mud, still mud in them. So he said, watch when the Yankees come out. Every shoe polished to perfection, shining black. He said, so, Joey, that's what makes Yankees so good. You take care of the little things. The big things take care of themselves. And that's a saying that he always told the team every year. Mm. And he was just – and he told me then. He pointed to me and goes, that's why you paint the shoes.
Mm.
Yeah, it's for the player's shoes. So
right.
I'm working on getting Ben back into
I love,
that
yeah.
tradition. So.
Well, when I came in, I would always see, you know, basic blues, black shoes, yeah. no name,
that's
all game.
That's where that came from.
Yeah. Oh, that's awesome. That yeah. That's fantastic. What was, I got to ask, I mean, you just being around Joe for so long, I know you just told a little bit. Yeah. Do you have a favorite Joe Pa story? So either saw him asking for a different, you know, random weird equipment or just anything in general with Joe Pa.
It's funny. With Joe, you always, we all have stories about getting bit by Joe. Okay? You know, I'm getting yelled at.
Yeah, obviously. Get chewed out.
So, and it's like we all suffered it. Coaches, trainers, managers, staff, I mean, whatever, and players. And he said, so one of my, we call them my classic, we all have classic bites. So I'll never forget this one. So it's 1989. I'm the assistant still equipment manager. But anyway, we're at Syracuse. Okay. And we're playing Syracuse and we're in field goal range. And it's right before halftime. But we have enough time in the clock to do one more play. So they run a little quick 5-yard hitch, trying to hit the tight end, get out of bounds, get a little closer to make it a short kick. Well, Tony, our quarterback at the time, Tony Sacca, and he was notorious for excuses. He comes back with the ball, takes a hike back, throws this wobbly duck pass, it's intercepted. No, time runs out, no points. Joe's going nuts. Nuts? Why'd you throw that ball, Sacca? So he's screaming at Sacca the whole way in the locker room. Now, I'm already in the locker room. I'd opened up the locker room. Mm. I'm already in there, not knowing this happened. And as soon as you open the door of the locker room, I'm right in the back. Trunks are all set up in the corner. Mm. Joe comes in. He goes, he's beelines right to me. Spider! He's like, so Tony told Joe, coming off the field, he said, Coach, the football was wet. So in he comes. Spider, why is the football so wet? And I'm like, what? Who's? And he's like, who's running the footballs? I'm like, well, the Syracuse managers are running the footballs. When you, back in the day, you didn't have enough managers. You only took six managers on the road.
Okay.
So you had the visiting, the host team ran your balls for them. They'd come to Beaver Stadium, we'd run their footballs for them. So he goes, what do you mean the Syracuse managers are running footballs? You get somebody on that right now. You know, so I'm like, okay, coach, we got it. You know, so, and he's like, so he storms back out. The whole team now is already in the locker room, sitting down, getting ready to make halftime adjustments, and they're all looking at me. And I'm just like totally dejected, and you know, shoulders are down. He's like, one of the coaches says, football wet. How can a football be wet when we're playing inside the carrier dome?
Tony, I forgot it was an indoor.
Tony Sacca is literally over there in his locker going like this, shrinking down, trying to hide in the corner. I'm like, I'm going to kill you, son of a bee. You took me, threw me down the river.
I can't believe that the football's wet on an indoor stadium. I guess maybe someone spit on it or something. Syracuse rubbing some water on it. Look, while we're on Joe Paterno stories, I have to ask you, we were talking just about this beforehand, but Adam Sandler in the late 90s came over to Penn State. He was doing a show here, and he wanted to meet Joe Paterno, as do most people. And he saw some things that led him to then, you know, I want to let you tell the story, but that he implemented and kind of the reason why he did the movie, The Water Boy.
Yeah.
So where did he get some of that inspiration from?
Well, first off, you know, when he came, you know, obviously a big deal, you know, and everybody was super excited, and he comes into the locker room first, and Joe wasn't there yet. He was still at home. So he's holding court, you know, he's in there, and the players were still in breakdown meetings. So he came back to just shoot the bull with us in the equipment room. So he's telling us stories, and just we're all laughing our rear ends off, you know. It's just so impromptu. We just this thing, and we're like, I can't believe this. It's just like you're just like in shock and awe, you know. So he's talking, you know, and it's funny, and so one of the coaches comes back and said, oh, hey, Adam, Joe just come in. He's ready to see you. He's like, oh, he goes, I'm nervous. So I'm like, what do you mean? So, oh, you got any advice? I'm really nervous to meet him. He's like, that's Joe Paterno, you know, but Brooklyn Net. He's a Brooklyn legend. And I'm like, well, we do have one suggestion for you. You better take your hat off, because he will yell at you if you have your hat on. Oh, thank you. So he whips his hat off, you know, and he's like, so sure enough, he went in, you know. But so I just got the biggest kick out of that. So he went to practice, him and his road manager, and they were actually filming on a little, you know, like a little camera. They were filming some of the, they were mainly interested in, you know, indies and stuff like that, during indies. So they're filming drills and everything and stuff like that. So he loved the fact that, at the time, our water that we used as managers and trainers, they were these little yellow plastic pumpers that you would actually pump, okay? And they had four hoses coming out of them. That's where you drink it, and you had to pump the pressure in, okay? Almost like a bug spray thing that you see today at Lowe's or whatever. So that's what we had on wheels, you know? So he was so fascinated with those, and he's filming them and said, ah, these are pretty. And so he's like squirting them around, you know, and kind of mimicking a couple, you know.
So being Adam Sandler.
Being Adam Sandler. Oh, geez, you know, so. Well, he loved it. So apparently that was his, he said later on, that was his inspiration for when he wears the backpack, and it was like a water thing for Water Boy, and it was kind of inspired him to be like a manager, and they called it Water Boy. He was so inspired by the practice and hanging out with us that was one of the inspirational things.
That is such a cool story. Yeah, man. Yeah, because everybody knows Water Boy. If you're a football fan, you've seen the Water Boy. It's a classic football movie. Yeah. So that is really cool. Got some inspiration from Penn State football for that movie. Man. Yeah. You're talking about how cool the locker room is and just that environment, and everybody loves you. The relationships you've built, I'm sure, have lasted you a lifetime. Can you just speak to, like, How do you do that? How do you cultivate those relationships? Is that just you being you? Is that an emphasis you put on to make those relationships?
Yeah, and that's probably what I miss the most, Landon, is that those relationships. I mean, I loved what I did. I do really miss what I did. I get out of it because it was time for me. It was the things are changing. The hours are brutal. They're tough. I mean, I had 31 years, and the stress of things, and it was just, you know, I wasn't used to change for 28 years. And then Coach O'Brien comes in, you kind of get used to his style. And then Coach Frank, I'm like, oh, no, another, I can't do this again, you know? And then we were fine. It was nothing, you know, we settled in, and with Coach Franklin transitioned his whole staff, and then just decided, I'm just ready for a change, you know? So
I did want to ask you that, though. What is that like from an equipment staff point of view when you have different coaches? How different do you guys operate? Does that affect you that much, the head coach? Does that completely change how you operate, or do you guys kind of go about it, you know, how you handle your business in the equipment room?
Well, as an example, when Coach O'Brien came in, I reached out to a bunch of other equipment managers and said, that have had other coaches. I said, what do I need to do? You know, like, I'm not used to this, you know, as the same guy and same staff for so long. Yeah. He's like, well, listen, just don't say this is the way we used to do it. What do you want me to do? What do you want done? How do you want it done? Don't say, like, well, we did it this way, we did it that way. So, and I was very careful with that, and I really appreciated that advice. Mm. It was just learning curves. Each one was a learning curve, you know. And, you know, Coach O'Brien, it was more, he's with the New England Patriots at the time. They're playing in the playoffs and eventually in the Super Bowl that year. Mm. You're trying to get information from him, and he's trying to form the team and coordinate everything there from afar. So I'm calling the Patriots constantly, trying to, he wants this, what's that, what's this, you know? Because it was totally different.
Was it already decided? So he was still coaching with the Patriots when he had already taken the job here?
Yeah. Yep.
Really?
Yeah. He committed to Belichick that I'll finish this out, you know? And we thought that I mean, the guys had a chance to go to the Super Bowl, and we totally understood. So,
yeah.
So he was coaching from afar. But basically he was flying in on Tuesdays, and then he would, like, because that was their day off, or Mondays, it was a Tuesday. And then he would do winter workouts and get a look at the guys, and he'd go back. And, so it was different. So pretty much his assistants were running it at the time until he got settled, and they ended up losing the Super Bowl. And then same with Coach Franklin. Coach Franklin comes in, it's like, well, you know, like, then it was a little bit easier because Coach O'Brien didn't have a support staff. He brought just his coaches in, okay? And he really didn't have any. He's forming a new staff from scratch, where Coach Franklin had his staff from Vanderbilt. Most of them came, so they know what he wants. They know what he needed.
Right.
So between Kevin Threlkeld, Michael Hazel at the time, Andy Frank, he wants this, he needs this, this is what he does here.
Yeah.
So it made it easier, and I could lean on those guys to help.
Right.
Okay, so I knew what they wanted, what the expectations were.
Right.
You know,
talking about Bill O'Brien, one thing I did want to ask you about is everybody remembers the year that we put the names on the back where the players put, Bill O'Brien came out, and that's what he said. He said, I want to honor these guys for sticking around, and we want to put their last names on the back of the jerseys for this year. So take me through that process. What was that like for the first time at Penn State putting names on the back of jerseys?
That was a interesting moment. I tell you, I totally understand why he did it. It was a good reason. And I just said, when he came to me, I said, Coach, and it was not his idea. It was actually the parents' idea. What happened was there were two things that Coach O'Brien did that really kept this team intact. One was he basically put out an all points bulletin for the Letterman to come back and help him convince the team to stay. Because remember, this is when you still couldn't transfer without sitting out a year, okay? This is before transfer portal. So literally, they made us free agency. And we literally had teams hiding in the bushes outside of Nittany Hall trying to recruit you guys. It was insane.
Yeah, I've heard stories from Mahdi and a couple other guys. Yeah, I mean, they're in Nittany apartments.
It was unbelievable.
Just all in there just trying to recruit.
Yeah. If you get a chance to see the movie, they have a documentary called Saving the Roar. It's called Saving the Roar.
Okay.
Okay? And it's going to be out more here. They'll get it going. But it's going to be, it interviews all those guys. It goes through the process. Even interviews Silas Red, who left to go to USC. Mm. And, you know, and he was in tears in this movie. So it really shows the emotion. It really very, very accurate on depicting that whole transition and what happened. It's very well done. Saving the Roar.
Okay. I'll have to check that out.
Yeah, check that. You can Google it. It'll give you at least a trailer, you know. But they're working to get it on Netflix or something eventually. So, but anyway, all these Lettermen come in. There was literally over 450 Lettermen showed up within 72 hours. Some guys were sleeping in their cars to come talk to the team about staying here. So we went up to Haluba Hall. No media, just us. We had some food up there, and the team come up, and all the former players. We met in they had chairs set up and bleachers and stuff, and they had one player from every era speak, from the 60s, the 70s, the 80s, the 90s, and their speeches were just, I wish we'd have filmed it. I don't think we did, but it was like, you know, just, hey, listen, Penn State's so much more than just X's and O's. I said, we've got your back, guys, okay? I said, we'll get through this with you. I say, and said, hang in there. He said, you'll appreciate Penn State alumni. We're going to take care of you, okay? So then that night, Coach O'Brien had a conference call with all the parents. What can I do to keep your son here? He said, I'll make this year fun. What do we need to do? I said, so it was with parents. One of the parents said, oh, you know, we've never had jerseys on our names in our history. What about doing something special and honoring the guys like that? And he said, nah, that's not a bad idea. Well, let me check on that. So he calls me. Now, this is like 2 weeks before the season. Spider, what do you think of this? I'm like, oh, well, Coach, I said, I get it, and it's not a bad idea. I said, but you got to convince the Letterman. They'll be pissed. I said, they guard this jersey like it's sacred. And I said, they'll be, you know, even our general public, I mean, they really, you got to make it, you know, if you just get the word out why, and I understand why, and I think it's a great reason, I said, to honor those guys. So we did it. And I always appreciated Coach Franklin for when he came, he didn't want to make any changes yet because he was trying to get a feel for the land. But then when the sanctions were lifted, he called us again, called me, called the local letterman. Kenny Jackson was one of them. Keith Conlon, all those guys in, and he said, hey, even Todd Kalka, hey, what do you guys think about it? I'm thinking of taking these the names off. We're like, absolutely. Right. I said, because if we kept the jersey's names on 20 years from now and you still see names on jerseys, it won't have any meaning.
Yeah.
Now when you see an ESPN Classic, you see Jame on the jersey, you know those are the guys that stayed committed here.
It represents a time period of those guys represent keeping Penn State together.
Yeah.
I think you're right, because even if anybody and me in my time period, if we had our names on our back, that wouldn't really mean anything because we weren't, you know, we were little kids for when all that happened. So I think you're dead on there.
So he called, and so he's like, okay, we're going to go for it, Spider, let's do it. So I'm like, okay, so I'm calling Nike, and Nike, I need these. He said, well, we can't do them for it. We'll send you the nameplates and the letters. So literally they sent me the nameplates blank and just a box of letters. Right. So I'm like, oh, geez. So we're in a hurry. So for now, I take them downtown. We have a downtown, they heat set them. They just take them the names, and they heat set them on the panels, okay? So I take the panels home. I take the jerseys. My wife did all our seamstress work. I would take all our jerseys, and after every game, I would take the jerseys that were ripped home, or pants. My wife did all the repairs. And all the bull patches she sewed on, all the bull patches. She did it for years. So I was like, well, hon, do you want to attempt this or not? She said, oh, yeah, we'll get it. You know, she's all in the she's a trooper. So I take these home, and so she starts sewing. I take 25 jerseys home at a time, do the starters first, then the second team, and do blue because we were blue first, and then the white second. So I'm trying to get them, you know, do them in shifts. So anyway, so she gets them all sewn on, you know, go to the first game, whatnot. Well, then we go to Virginia, which is the second game. We're at Virginia. So it was a real hot, humid day. The letters start falling off. They're literally peeling off in that back. And I mean, it was a big joke. If you watch the Virginia game in 2000, what was it, 12, I guess, even the announcers are laughing. Say, well, either Coach Paterno is up there scraping them off from heaven, or you know, and we know Penn State's not really experienced with putting names on their jerseys. Dave Joyner calls me. And we didn't really too much of a problem with the blue ones the week before. We had a few that were kind of funny, but so Dave Joyner, the AD, called me Monday. Get that fixed, Spider. What the hell is going on? You know, I'm like, okay, Dave, I'll fix it. I'll do it. So I said, Karen, we don't have time. Apparently, they didn't heat set them hot enough. And then with that humidity, they were just starting to peel off. The sticky wasn't sticky enough. So I took them home. I said, my dear wife, she said, listen, bring them home. I'll sew every individual letter on. We're not going to take the panel off. We're just going to sew right through the jersey permanently. So that jersey, I said, I'll be giving those jerseys away at the end of the year anyway. So she just literally sewed every single end letter on right through the jersey, the whole thing permanently on the jersey. And I did the same thing, took it home in shifts. So she, you know, there was a couple games where we didn't have them all done yet, but just the starters were done. And then we kept working through the
talk about
games.
Talk about teamwork.
So it was crazy.
The wife helping you out big time.
She had blisters on that one. So we're still married. So I guess I didn't.
You kept her around.
Right.
It worked out. Spotter, one thing I wanted to talk to you about is I spoke to a couple lettermen from, you know, the Joe Paterno era, and they tell me about how bowl games used to be really different, and you guys used to go down almost 2 weeks before. And for those of you that don't know, right now, You normally go down about 6 days, sometimes 7 days before. Yeah. It's normally, you normally leave on Christmas. You generally do not get to spend Christmas with your family, Thanksgiving, none of it. So that's some sacrifice that you do have to make as a college football player. Yeah. But even Coach Franklin now, some teams go down only 4 or 5 days before. Yeah. Coach Franklin's big emphasis on that is, hey, I want you guys to have a day or two where you don't have much to do down at the bowl site. You guys go out, explore, you know, use your stipend that we give you. See, a lot of guys on the team haven't even been on an airplane before. Yeah. So it's like, let's go enjoy that. So I've heard that Joe Paterno used to take you guys down about 2 weeks early. Yep. And not only 2 weeks early, but they would go to a different site than the bowl site. So I have to imagine for the equipment managers, that's a little bit of a nightmare doing two major moves while you're in the bowl site. Can you talk about that?
It was a lot of work. I mean, a logistics nightmare. You figure from the time we load at State College, okay, and get down there and do the first practice site, then the second practice site, then move to the stadium, and then bring it back. Mm. We've loaded and unloaded the truck 8 times. Okay, and you know, you're taking, you know, we take our own pads, you know, the shields, take all the pads, you know, jugs, machines, everything. So it literally, that's what we do. Joe liked to go down. He wanted to get out of Dodge, get away from the crappy weather, and get down there and concentrate. Because, you know, he up here, they were distracted with stuff. Get your finals done. And he'd let them go home for, like, we'd practice Friday, Saturday, right after the season was over, and then the next Friday, Saturday, it was all about getting ready, getting your studies done, and stuff like that. So you only have like 4 practices before we left here, okay, for the bowl. Then go home. Like, some guys didn't have any finals, or some guys maybe had a final on Monday. Then you had that whole week, but then he wanted you down there on like the 19th or 20th. Okay, we'd fly down. We'd have 2 days.
That's what I heard. That was like the old heads were telling me. Because nowadays, those bowl practices, they're pretty chill. I mean, you get after it, but it's kind of laid back. They're like, no, we were having camp practices, like August-style practices at the bowl site. And I'm like, dude, this is supposed to be like a trip, like a fun thing now. And Joe Paterno had those boys down there sweating away.
So we would go, and the reason, see, the bowl only had you there for like you could actually come in Christmas Eve to the bowl. That was the earliest you're allowed to go. So anything prior to that, we had to organize on our own. Now, the NCAA rule, you had to be within 100 miles of the area, so you still couldn't go real far away. Mm-hmm. You know, not like you could go to Bermuda and do it and then come back. So you had to stay. So we were always like, you know, we'd stay at Melbourne Beach if we were in, like the Citrus Bowl, or we'd stay in Tampa. We'd stay at like St. Pete Beach, whatever. You know, we practiced at a high school or the Jesuit High School. We practiced different places. We would totally organize that ourselves. One time we went down and used the Phillies, Bright House or whatever, their training facility.
Right.
We used the Phillies facility, which was a lot of fun. It was a really fun trip. And when we played in the Outback Bowl 1 year. So, we would go, so we get there like on the 20th. We'd have 2 practices on the 21st, 2 on the 22nd, 2 on the 23rd. And Christmas Eve morning, we'd have a practice. Then we'd pack up Christmas Eve, move to the Bull Hotel Christmas Eve, okay?
These guys weren't having a jolly Christmas at all. They were having a rough Christmas.
So Joe was even like, okay. And then we'd have that day. Then we'd have Christmas Day off and the day after. Mm. Okay, he would give them the 2 days. And then we would, boom, then we could start in the game week routine, okay? And then it wasn't quite as intense. I mean, he would, you know, but he wanted those coming off the 4 practices at home and the 7 practices there. Then he wanted to be ready when we moved to the bowl site. So, but yeah, it was intense. I'll never forget. We played Kentucky in the Outback Bowl 1 year. Or was it Citrus Bowl? Anyway, we played Kentucky. I think it was Outback. And anyway, the guys, we're having one of our bowl functions with them, you know, and we're talking about, we just got pads off the other day. What? I said, yeah, we finally got just to go in helmets, or tops. We call tops, you know. He's like, We haven't had shoulder pads for like 2 months. And I'm like, I said, yeah, we had 2 days. Like, what? They're like,
when I heard that from some of these lettermen, the 2 days on Christmas Eve, I'm like, man, it was not a good Christmas back then. But hey, when you won, it was probably a good time.
Joe, he definitely was old school. That's for sure.
Yeah. What was your favorite bowl game?
I'm always a big Fiesta Bowl fan. I mean, I like the area. Awesome. I love the area. Just unique. You know, they were always so good to us. You know, we had a great record there. They always really enjoyed us. Orange Bowl did a nice job too. We've been to two Orange Bowls. The second Orange Bowl was really special. They really did a nice job too. But the Fiesta Bowl is definitely my favorite.
Okay. Yeah. That's Arizona. That's a cool place. That's really a unique place.
Yeah, it really is. And like I said, that 86 national championship was really it was really a Super Bowl of college football at the time, and we.
Yeah, as your first year, that had to be so special. That's fantastic.
Yeah,
Spider, I want to ask you, what is the weirdest either superstition or just unique thing you were asked for to do as an equipment manager for a player or coach? Yeah. Just something odd that you don't normally hear about.
Yeah, let's see. Everybody had their like little pet T-shirts they wore in high school, and I got to keep wearing this one, you know.
Yeah.
You'd have like
dirty socks from middle school.
Oh yeah, I mean all kind of little things like that were always very funny and unique, you know, with guys. And then you'd have certain guys that have to do these certain routines, you know. And you're like, oh, but only Spider can, you know, adjust my helmet, or only this guy is, you know, this manager is the only one that can and help me with pull my jersey over the shoulder pads. You know, like Mark D'Onofrio, who played linebacker for us in the early '90s. He was a real intense, you know, jersey guy, you know, and he'd always, and he had a shoulder issue, so you couldn't put the shoulder pads on first, like with a jersey on it. Sometimes, you know, he had to actually put the shoulder pads on, tape his shoulder pads almost to his body with his shoulder, then they pull the jersey over, and it was so hard, you know. So you're literally, you know, scraping, but he won't let me do it, you know. So I'm like, I could barely get this thing over his head and shoulder pads, and he's screaming and yelling. He would always scream and yell, and as soon as he's done, he'd go over and throw up in the garbage can every single game. Every time I get the jersey on, his next routine was to throw up in a garbage can.
Was he ready to puke, or did he pull trigger?
He just literally, I think because when you lift so much and you get that point where you just have to go throw, and it's like, I just think he worked himself. He was so worked up and nervous for the game and worked up that always sent him over the edge to throw up, and he did every time.
That's fantastic. That's throw it before. Yeah. Hey, you know, whatever works. That's what you got to find. You got to find what makes you play the best and you stick with it.
Yep.
There's been talks of guys wanting to wear pink jerseys and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. I do want to ask you if you were able to put together your not the greatest uniform, but something really cool. What would you go with? Whether that's pink, whether that's putting the numbers on the helmet. If you were able to design a uniform right now, what do you think you'd put together?
Yeah, I really feel. I think the pink uniform is coming.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know that for a fact. Don't quote me, but I just think they're going to work their way into it. I think our fans would embrace it. I really do. I think, you know, the whole Generations of Greatness jersey, that was actually originally, we talked about it with Coach O'Brien. Okay. Now, he decided not to do it, because I actually took the idea to him. I said, because he, when the sanctions came down and he wanted to, and you know, he's trying to throw a bone to the players, you know, he did the jersey names on the jerseys. He's like, what else can we do, you know, just that it's safe enough that, you know, and I'm like, well, I said, our fans really relate to the teams from the 60s and 70s, and especially the 68-69 team. That was the two undefeated teams that we had. That were really put Penn State on the map back in the day, and we were on a 30-0 run that year, and we never won a national title, okay. And that's the other reason that Coach Paterno was always for the playoff. He always wanted a playoff. I wish he was alive to be able to see it changing to the 12 teams. He would actually like that, because those numbers on the side of the on the suites behind our behind our sideline, a lot of those. Those are championships or undefeated seasons.
Right.
Joe has 7 undefeated seasons and only 2 national titles. It's insane.
Yeah, that's awesome. Literally, I mean, we've been robbed a couple times.
Big time, especially '94.
Yeah. Anyway. I say that I hear about it all the time I do a couple of shows with Goon, with Keith, and that 94 offense, everybody talks about it. I mean, it was like the greatest show on turf.
Yeah.
And no one could stop them.
Yeah. Yeah, it was amazing. So and Their average scoring drive was 2 minutes and 12 seconds that year. I mean, you almost felt like we could score at will. It was great. And I remember first game of the season we played Minnesota. We killed them in the Metrodome like 56-3 or 6. And I remember after the game, we're shaking hands with the coaches and players, and they're, one of their coaches said to our coach, said, you know, we knew exactly what you were going to run. We couldn't stop it.
That's true dominance.
Yeah,
when you know what's coming and you can't do anything about it.
Right.
It is helplessness and it is dominance on the other side.
So anyway,
Campus Steaks is the official sponsor of the Behind the Wall podcast. Go check them out at Pew Street in downtown State College. They got the best cheesesteaks, French fries, onion rings, you name it, and they got it. It's a Philly thing. Well, I do want to ask you. We can move on. I want to ask you what is the best piece, and obviously from handling Joe Paterno's shoes to just all types of legendary players, what's the best piece of Penn State memorabilia that you still have to this day?
Well, the one that I have two things, and they're both Joe. I mean, I have Joe the last pair of shoes that Joe wore, and again, they're going to be in the museum when we get another, we get its final display, whatever. But I have. And they were custom-made shoes for him this last few years. And then the jacket he wore when he won his 400th win, it was another custom jacket that we kind of had a heat panels put in it. And it's battery-powered, and we actually would change the battery at halftime. And he loved that. We got it for him for practice, and he loved that. He started wearing it for games.
Well, around what year was that?
It was 2000, and the jacket was from 2009. And then, so for 2010, 2011, he wore that jacket.
Okay, that's cool technology, because only recently, I actually have one of those, but they didn't really start making those until a couple years ago.
We sent it to a company in Canada that did it for us.
Oh, okay.
It was a raincoat, fleece raincoat line that was all the coaches got it, but for his, we decided that, for practice, let's put some heat panels in it, because Joe would come to practice, he's just wearing like a hoodie, and he always looked cold by the end of practice. You know, he's 80 years old by then. And we're like, oh, coach, we got to... he said, you go take a coat to him or something at practice, and he'd be like, get that away from me. He was tough, and he did not want to be babied.
Right.
You know? And so I'm like, okay, freeze him. So we had this made, and he loved it. So,
That's awesome.
That's special. I mean, I had, I did have one time I had his shoes that he wore in a national championship game in 86, but I ended up giving him his son, Joey, which was his grandson, Joey.
Yeah,
because they were real special. But, so those are the two pieces I really cherish.
That's awesome. Spider, last thing I want to ask you, man, obviously being around from early 80s to 2010s, you saw a lot of special guys come through this program.
Yeah.
What was there any time that a player really stuck out to you, especially as a freshman or a sophomore, as a young cat, and you were like, that guy's going to be special? Like, when did you ever see anybody and you just really could tell, just being around the program, that dude is going to be something?
I always said – And it's hard. I mean, there's been so many great guys. And somebody asked me, how many football players have you outfitted with equipment over the years? And I said, well over 1,000, probably about 1,200 players I've put equipment on over my career. And Penn State football players. And I said, but a guy to me that, again, there's so many great guys. And I hate to single one person, but a guy that really epitomized the Penn State football player. And what I mean by that is hard-nosed, blue-collar, super person, great student. His locker was spotless, just a great guy to be around, but yet on the field he was an animal. An intensity level was second to none, was Paul Posluszny. Paul was just a quality person, and I always just thought, man, he epitomizes who Penn State football is.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't know why that was like telepathically.
Really?
I was hearing Paul. I don't know why. I could sense it, because he is those linebackers. They set the standard here, and they still carry it to this day.
They do.
There is a standard that is set, and they set the bar high. And these guys, they reach it every time.
Well, I got to meet Coach Allen a couple months ago when he first started, and it was just neat to see him. He's thrilled to be here, and he just said, I can't believe I oversee. I'm part of linebacker U now, and you can just see the pride he took in that, and knowing, like, I have Dan Connor in my meetings, I can't believe it, I really thought, oh man, that's great, I just appreciate it.
Yeah, those are some good pickups. We got some good coordinators, and absolutely. Look, Spider, absolutely a pleasure having you on. 31 years as the Penn State equipment manager, absolute legend here, everybody loves him and still around. We're so happy to have him.
Appreciate
Thank you so much for coming on.
My pleasure, it's been great, been a lot of fun.
Thank you.